So I'm going to jump on in. We introduced the book of Hebrews 2 weeks ago and then belabored the matter of what I call the prologue, the first four verses last week. And I suggested then that in a number of our New Testament books, you have these prologues and we don't put enough weight on them. They tell us what the book's about. James has a prologue. First John has a prologue. Most books do in some way have this prologue that really guides what the book is about. But that said, there's an argument being made in the first two chapters, and that's part of the challenge of teaching a book like Hebrews, is that you never have enough time unless we had like 4 hours to do the first two chapters. And so what people tend to do is start in the middle. What I'll try to do every time is take us back for a moment to how we got where we're at. You have to do that in Hebrews, even when you get to chapter 9. How did you get to chapter 9? Well, if you did it right, you started in chapter 1 and you sort of got on this sort of raft, and you're floating down the river with the writer, and he's going through a number of arguments and showing things to you, and you've got to have all of that in mind to put chapter 9 together. So fortunately, we don't have to go that far since it's the first chapter, but I am going to share my screen, and I did something here to try to demonstrate something. And this is one place where doing this by Zoom is actually a real benefit, because I make a statement frequently about when you're seeing Old Testament quotations in the New, go back and look at them in some context. And I'm going to show you exactly what I mean by showing you the Old Testament version next to the New, except for that one place where he quotes the Old Testament and it doesn't exist anymore, which is an interesting thing. We'll get there though. And as I said, it's not a simple argument. I mean, he wants to say that Jesus is superior to angels. And I think his primary reason for doing that, is that the angels brought the law of Moses. And if Jesus is superior to angels, then his words are superior to the law of Moses. The writer will go out of his way, as Paul would elsewhere in his writings, to say that there's nothing, that the law is good and holy, but it has a limited purpose. The law was never designed to enable somebody to be justified or sanctified. That's the argument of the book of Galatians. And so as people in this book, in the context that I've tried to show you in the first lesson, are Jewish Christians contemplating perhaps a return to the synagogue because of prolonged persecution, that which they would go back to, a religion that is centered on Torah, is inferior to what he will call in chapter 2, so great salvation that Jesus taught. And he also will then say, if you realize that there are consequences of disobedience to the law of Moses, how much more so consequences for disobedience to this so great salvation that Jesus taught? Okay, so that's the reason he needs to say that Jesus is superior to angels. But he also wants us to understand the implications of Jesus being a son and not an angel. So with that said, let's look at Hebrews 5, or chapter 1, verse 5, rather. And I've got it on the screen. If someone's listening to this recording, I'd really urge you to go see the video so you can see these notes, and they'll be posted on the sermon audio where you can download it and just see a parallel between the New and the Old Testament here. But he quotes the Old Testament twice. And in fact, throughout this chapter, he quotes the Old Testament. He expects that his audience knows these passages, which is a strong indicator that he believes they're Jewish. And he will ramp this up in the chapters to come. He will so pervasively quote the Old Testament that it just makes it very unlikely that he has anybody in mind as his audience other than Jewish people with a fairly good knowledge of their Old Testaments. Now, that said, he's going to do one other thing in these quotes, and I want to emphasize this in each one. They're all about the kingdom, basically. Okay. So when you get to the first so-called warning passage, which is a difficult one in chapter 2, he's talking about salvation. The question becomes, what salvation? One of the biggest errors people make in exegeting New Testament passages is assuming salvation always means your justification, when over half the time it has nothing to do with that. And so he's setting a context here. And in chapter 2, verse 5, he's going to say very explicitly, we've been talking about the world to come, a rabbinic expression, a Jewish expression for the coming kingdom. And so you'll see it right here in chapter 1, verse 5. You're my son. Today I've become your father. And I don't want to worry about the rest of it right now. I just want to focus on that part. That is from, and I should have wrote it here on the right-hand column, that is Psalm 2, okay? Psalm 1 and 2 serve as introductions to the whole book of Psalms. And the book of Psalms is actually five separate books. Do not think of those books of Psalms, the five books, as just being, you know, we got all the ones we liked and we just kind of threw them down on paper. They're very purposely organized. Psalm 1 is a reminder that we should take great delight in the Word of God, and it should make us like a tree planted by a canal, sort of you irrigate the river and you bring that canal off so that it will feed and cause to flourish this tree, and you are that tree. Okay, so that's important. And then Psalm 2 reminds them that these promises of them becoming Messiah, despite all the bad things that had happened to Israel over the years with them being taken into captivity and stuff, those promises stand. And Psalm 2 is a thoroughly messianic psalm. And he says in verse 7, I will declare the Lord's decree. He said to me, you're my son. Today I've become your father. And I wanted you to see the verse after that. Now, God is speaking. God the Father speaks to the Son. He says to the Son, you are my son. Today I've become your father. Okay. Then he says to the Son, ask of me and I'll make the nations your inheritance and the ends of the earth your possession. Remember that the introduction or the prologue that we covered last time, did it not say that he has appointed him heir of all things? Okay. Mm-hmm. Where did he get that? Well, it's in a number of places, but it's prominently right here. This idea of you've become my son, today I've become your father. I'm going to show you how the Apostle Paul interprets that passage. And I would also, I won't show you Matthew 22, but you can go there and say, well, how does Jesus interpret this passage? This passage comes up repeatedly in the New Testament. But it's the context here. When he declares him my son, he now has the legal entitlement to ask of the Father, and the Father will give him his inheritance. And his inheritance is everything. Okay? The nations, the ends of the earth, it's all yours. In fact, he says, you will break them with an iron scepter. You'll shatter them like pottery. This is what we sometimes call Armageddon. It's the subject of Revelation 19 and in Zechariah 14 and a bunch of different passages. But understand that this is not looking, I'm going to show you that verse 7 looks to a declaration made at the resurrection of Christ. But this is a kingdom passage about how at a moment in time, God will give it all to him and he can take it. And when you read the book of Revelation, you can kind of see that unfold because in chapter 6, they scour all of creation, heaven and earth, looking for someone who can approach the Father and take the scroll. And Jesus does it. It has seven seals on it, indicating that God has sealed it and only God can unseal it. And as God begins to unseal it, the Son of God, you see all these things happen that are leading up to what happens here. Think of Revelation 6 as the moment that Jesus asked and said, I'm ready to take it. Okay. So look at, and I'll pause after I show you this Acts passage because it's a hard passage, but what I want you to get hold of every time he quotes this Old Testament, he has the kingdom in mind. Okay. So if we go to, too far. I'm still showing Hebrews 2:5, you're my son, today I've become your father. But in Acts 13, Paul preaches to a Jewish audience in the synagogue, And he's being evangelistic, as he always does. Every time you have any extended passage of, or sermon in the book of Acts, they talk about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And Paul, true to the pattern in Acts 13, gets to his big punchline, God raised him from the dead. And he appeared for many days to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now as witnesses to the people. So the apostles and some other disciples who witnessed his earthly ministry. And then he says, and we ourselves proclaim to you the good news or the gospel, the promise that was made to our ancestors or to the fathers, stuff way back in the Old Testament. I wonder where it was made. Well, it was made in Psalm 2. He says, God has fulfilled this for us. What has he fulfilled? The promise made in Psalm 2. He's fulfilled this for us, their children, by raising up Jesus, as it's written in the second Psalm, you're my son, today I've become your father. You see how the declaration is tied to the resurrection. It's not that Jesus is not son before that. This is a legal declaration. And it's the legal declaration that you are now heir of all things. And that's why I showed you more of Psalm 2 a moment ago. When the writer of Hebrews quotes Psalm 2, his assumption, and it's a good one, is they know the whole thing. And they understood it was a messianic psalm. And they understood that the rest of this, you are my son, and when you ask me, I will give you the nations. So let me pause there. Question about the Psalm 2, or Hebrews 2, saying it wrong, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5, Psalm
2. I've got a quick question, yeah. Hudson. I read somewhere, and I couldn't find where it was, that on the day that Israel crowned a king, or God put a king ahead of Israel, that they became a son of God. Am I missing something on that?
No, I think there are several... There's several concepts, I think, in Jewish thought where that comes up. And I have read that, in my memory, I've read that within something that Arnold Fruchtenbaum wrote probably in his Yeshua series, the like four-volume series through the Gospels. I'm relatively sure I've read that there. I could be mistaken, but I've absolutely read that. And in fact, we're going to see it in a moment because that concept's embedded in Psalm 45. Which the writer of Hebrews will quote in a moment, and it's a fascinating quote that he would pick. So when he says, "You're my son, today I've become your father," or like the King James, "Today I've begotten you," he's not talking about the creation of Jesus. Like, that's not a concept in the scripture, but it's something people have tried to argue from verses like this. He's talking about the resurrection, okay? Jesus has eternality, and that'll come out of one of the other quotes he will provide us in a moment. But it's the declaration, and this ties back to the prologue, that you're going to be heir of all things. This is kingdom focus, okay? And we want to keep that in mind because every one of them will be. Then we get to this other part that I didn't do before. He says, and notice it's a rhetorical question. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You're my son"? And the answer is none. He never said that to an angel. He only said, "You are my son," to a son. And again, another question, for to which of the angels did he ever say, "I will be his father and he will be my son"? And it's a rhetorical question. The answer is he never said that either. This is showing Jesus is superior in rank and status to the angels, and in fact holds this role as his son. Now, this is a long passage over here in 2 Samuel 7. If you've never heard the expression, I'll introduce a term to you that's just helpful for talking about it, and that's the concept of a Davidic covenant. We have these things in the Bible, we really should think of them as promises for the most part, and we call them covenants. Covenant has a legal connotation today. I think in the Old Testament times, it may have been somewhat different. That is, you had different kinds of covenants. You could have a covenant where one merely made some promises with a certain type of cultural assurance that it was certain to come true. Okay, so with the Abrahamic covenant that you read about in Genesis, Abraham is caused to fall asleep because he contributes nothing to the covenant from that standpoint. It's not a covenant that says, well, Abraham, if you'll be a good boy, then I will give you some promises. So God caused him to fall asleep, and an animal is sacrificed, and it becomes a blood covenant because he walks between the animal parts and things like that. But it's kind of one directional. That is, it's primarily unconditional promises about things that will happen. Then with God and the nation of Israel, once he builds it, we have this covenant that we sometimes call the Mosaic covenant. It's the law. And I do like the word covenant there. In our modern context, we would call it a bilateral contract because there are terms that are fulfilled by God and terms that are fulfilled by the people. When we speak in modern terms of a bilateral contract, both sides have obligations. Both sides have rights. Whereas with the Abraham covenant, like I said, it's kind of one-sided. So we have these covenants in the scriptures, and they're really important because much of the scripture is written around those covenants, and it's important to know what covenants in view when you read, for example, most of the writing prophets. You read a book like Micah, you know, what's the big background context? And it's usually that covenant with Israel. So then we have this what we sometimes call the Davidic covenant. It's just promises. And what has happened in 2 Samuel 7 is that David, King David, around 1000 BC, is around the time he was alive, he was very interested in making a temple. Now, there was a tabernacle, the temporary tabernacle with the Ark of the Covenant, but he wanted to build God a permanent dwelling place, a temple where he could be manifested. And God basically ends up saying, you're not going to do that for me. Someone else will. Okay. And that'll be Solomon. But I'm going to build a house for you. Okay. And by house, he has in mind, you know, kind of, we think of the concept of maybe a dynasty. And so that's what happens, here in 2 Samuel 7. And we call it covenant because of these promises. And what God says, you look at it, verse 8, this is what the Lord of armies says. I took you, David, from the pasture, tending the flock. He was just a young man to be ruler over my people. I've been with you everywhere you've gone. I've destroyed your enemies. I'm going to make a great name for you, like all the greatest of the earth. I'll designate a place for my people, Israel, and I'll plant them. You should say, well, I thought they were already there. He's looking forward to some degree. He says, I'll designate a place for my people so they can live there and not be disturbed again. That's not happened, right? They're not in the land right now. And he goes on, and you know, evildoers won't continue to oppress them as they've done ever since the day I ordered judges to be over my people. I'll give you rest from all your enemies. And then the Lord declares to you, you see that verse? The Lord declares to you, the Lord himself will make a house for you. Okay? David wanted to make a house, but he means something different by a house. This isn't a dwelling place now. When your time comes to basically die, he says, I'll raise up after you your descendant who will come from your body, and I'll establish his kingdom. And I think that's Solomon. But he goes on, he is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. And then he says, when he does wrong, I'll discipline him. It seems that here, God speaks to David of Solomon, but also of one for whom Solomon is more of a type or a figure. And it's that one that the writer of Hebrews picks up on and says, he's talking about Jesus in the first half of verse 14. Okay, I will be his father and he'll be my son. And people often ask, well, why is that other part there about when he does wrong? Jesus won't do wrong. He's clearly looking to an immediate fulfillment in part and then a future fulfillment. Okay, so let me pause there. I should say one other thing. this is a kingdom passage, right? Because in the first advent, Jesus didn't take the throne and rule forever in that sense. This is looking to the second advent. So, question or comment about, this part that's quoted from 2 Samuel 7? Hebrews 1:6. When he brings his firstborn into the world, he says, and let all of God's angels worship him. Now, put on your Jewish sandals. How can God tell angels to worship anybody else? Do you see an immediate problem with that?
Well, yeah, I always look at, I think it's the passage in Isaiah where it says, you know, I'm the Lord and my glory will I not give to another. Mm-hmm. So the aspect of if God is saying worship this person, then he's either A, contradicting himself, or B, equating that second person with God and divinity.
That it's absolutely right. It's you got a real problem if God says to worship someone else, that someone else has to either be God or that person or God's telling you to commit a serious violation. I mean, the Big Ten suggests that we, you know, right, the Ten Commandments, don't, you know, worship anybody else. And in the scripture, even when you see someone begin to worship the wrong person, for example, when people started to worship the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts because they saw him do some signs, he said, we're just, you know, it was him and I think it was, I think Barnabas, but I may be misremembering, but he said, we're just people, we're just humans, don't worship us. And in the book of Revelation, there's a time when John kneels down before an angel and the angel says, no, I'm just a servant like you, get up. This is an Old Testament proof of the deity of Christ, and there are many, but I'm just saying, now the problem with this passage is let all the God's angels worship him. My King James Bible does not have that in Deuteronomy 32, verse 43, and my Christian Standard Bible also doesn't have it. Did anyone find this in their translation? Or is it just missing from all of them?
I want to look that up. Not now, but yeah, that brings up a good point. But yeah, maybe I'll get back to you later.
Yeah, it would be a curious thing if someone, you know, if one of the translations has it. A week or two back, I had a really snarly comment to something I had posted online that did a word study of this term that we see in the New Testament, eklektos. It's translated usually something like elect. And I use the Septuagint, okay, and you'll see on the screen I wrote LXX. That's a common abbreviation for the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was already in use in the first century. And the gnarly sort of thing was, well, you look at the completely spurious Septuagint to try to prove your point, and therefore it was very specific. I will not listen to anything you have to say. And I responded that the author of Hebrews thought it was good enough to quote. But not only the author of Hebrews. In fact, it's quoted a lot in the New Testament. Now, that does not mean, and I'm not saying that means that every translation in the Septuagint is accurate, but what I'm saying is that our New Testament writers used it a lot, and they used it here, but there's something more. We have a copy of Deuteronomy from not only the Greek translation that we call the Septuagint, and, you know, it makes sense that we would have a Septuagint to a Greek-speaking world. You would want to translate the Old Testament. But we have an ancient copy from the Qumran scrolls. So when our Bibles are translated, King James and in fact most translations, they primarily rely on the Masoretic text, although some of the newer translations will consider variations found between the Masoretic which maybe dates to, you know, 1200, you know, AD 1200 or maybe a little earlier, but they'll compare it to Qumran scrolls that may even come, you know, they can be before Jesus. So they're in that, you know, 100 BC, you know, that time frame a little bit after the, you know, in the beginning of the first century. So you have some very ancient Qumran scrolls, and they're largely consistent with the Masoretic, but here's a place where they're different. And it's just to say that both the LSX and the Qumran scroll has this verse. It simply isn't in our translations in general. Go ahead.
Sorry to interject, but I was wondering if most of the translations, or many of the translations, some of them don't have it, and would that be similar to, like, when there's references to the Book of Jasher in the Bible, or references to the Assumption of Moses in the Book of Jude? Could it be similar to the aspect of there was a writing in antiquity that, you know, wasn't necessarily, I'm not saying this verse isn't, but wasn't necessarily deemed in the entirety of scripture, and they're taking out of that to apply, like when it references Book of Jasher in Chronicles and Kings, I believe it is, or what are your thoughts?
So I think that concept happens sometimes, right? Like the Book of Jude seems to pull a little bit of material from the Book of Enoch. Doesn't mean that the Book of Enoch is inspired, but it does mean the verses that are quoted in Jude are correct. But there we know that the author is quoting something that doesn't seem to be widely recognized as canonical. Here it presents a much more unique problem, because the very fact that he would quote this verse only makes sense if his audience accepts that this is from Deuteronomy 32. And it's part of the Torah, so there's no question of canonicity. What I'm suggesting is simply that this is one of the areas where, because of a textual problem, you have an old, you know, you have a problem in the Old Testament translation. It's not a big deal, but, you know, there's a difference between us saying that the original autographs, the time when Paul put the pen to the sheepskin is inerrant. There's a difference between that and then the question of whether in copies over time we might have gotten some errors. What the Qumran scrolls show us is that we have a very reliable translation of the Old and New, you know, of the Old Testament, because you can compare transcripts we have or manuscripts we have, most of which predate Jesus, and you can compare them to the Masoretics 1,000 or 1,200 years later, and almost all of the disagreements are not substantive in that sense. But this is one where, you know, I'm not highly trained on textual criticism. I just, you know, you can't avoid it when you go through Hebrews, that he clearly is quoting the Old Testament. It's not in our Old Testament. Go ahead.
The English Standard Version does have it.
Oh,
with a note. And the note says that the Masoretic text does not have it.
Right. Right. And the Masoretic was used for the King James. And I'm not suggesting that that's bad. It's just that's all we had. But also, if you go study how the Masoretic text was done, great measures were taken, to ensure accuracy. Why this phrase would have got dropped out at some point, I have no idea. But that's interesting. So the ESV has it, just shows that they've kind of recognized this. So in Deuteronomy 32, you have what we call the Song of Moses. And the Song of Moses is an interesting passage, because it begins to look forward, and in the passage that's quoted, he looks forward to a time that's kind of a surprising thing for him to say, but, you know, because it's all about Israel. Now he says to the nations, to the Gentiles, to everybody, rejoice. Why? Why would they rejoice? Skip over the part in yellow that I have. Why would they rejoice? Because this coming Messiah figure, will avenge the blood of his servants, take vengeance on his adversaries, purify his land. When did that happen? See, did not happen at the first advent. This is another kingdom passage. But, you know, the God's revelation is progressive. So, you know, you don't get a fulsome concept of the kingdom until more of the Old Testament unfolds in time. But you begin seeing the seeds of a coming Messiah as early as Genesis 3. And by the time you get to the Torah, we need to understand the Torah was designed to look forward to Christ. And here we have this great passage looking forward to the coming one who would avenge and all that. That looks like stuff we read in Psalm 2. And it's in that context that God says, let the angels worship this coming Messiah. That's a powerful statement to the deity of Christ. And I think that's why he quotes it here in Hebrews 1:6, because you wouldn't have the angels worship him unless he was God, right? Unless he was equal to God. And that's his point. And it's, these are pretty powerful arguments when you think about it, especially to a Jewish world that I think in a lot of ways missed the idea that the Messiah would be a son. Okay. Verse 7 in chapter 1, he says, and about the angels, he says, so the prior verses were talking about a son. The angels will worship the son, which means what? The son is superior to the angels, right? Pretty simple argument. That was the prior verse. The son will be appointed heir of the world. God will declare him his son. All these things about the son. Now he says, let's go back to the Old Testament and see what it says about angels. And so he quotes from Psalm 104, and I've given some context here. It's a wonderful psalm. This is a creation psalm, as sometimes people will call it, because and you read the whole thing. It has a focus on the Creator God. But if you remember the prologue to Hebrews, did he not say that God has appointed him heir of all things and made the universe through him? See, the writer of Hebrews views this Psalm 104 as a psalm about Jesus. Okay, that's what he's telling us. And so when Psalm 104 says, my soul bless the Lord, Lord my God, you're very great, you're clothed with majesty and splendor. It's about Jesus. He wraps himself in the light as if it were a robe, spreading out the sky like a canopy. This is the Creator Jesus. And the prologue said that the Father made the world through Jesus, or really made the universe. We talk about that because he doesn't use the word cosmos. He uses the word aeons, time and space, laying the beams of his palace on the waters above, making the clouds his chariot. It's all poetic language to describe creation. He's not trying to be scientific. And making the winds his messengers, which the Hebrews author understands winds here as a figurative use of the word wind to represent the angels. Okay. And he made them his servants. Flames of fire is also a figurative term for the angels. And they are the servants of who? The Creator. And who is the Creator according to the prologue? The Son. Okay. And then he goes on in verse 5, he, Jesus, established the earth on its foundations. It'll never be shaken. So, and by the way, in Psalm 104, and I don't have it quoted here, but I'm going to go back and find it. There was one verse in there. It's really helpful to read the whole thing because it goes somewhere with this part about him being the Creator. I think it's in there. I'm just going to double check and I'll read it to you. But let's see. It's a long psalm, but I think there might have been one other verse really interesting there, but I'm not seeing it now. It's all right. So, again, Jesus appeared to angels. Why? He is the creator God for whom the angels were made to be his servants. And then verse 8, this is a wonderful psalm. It's what we call a royal psalm because it speaks to a king. Hebrews author is quoting Psalm 45, and he's quoting the two verses I have highlighted in yellow, Psalm 45, 6 to 7. But when you read Psalm 45, it begins speaking, it seems, of someone else, and then it begins to look forward. So when you read it, the psalmist says, "My heart is moved by a noble theme, and I recite my verses to the king." So the psalmist has written this psalm, it would seem, for a king who is living at that time. He says, "You're the most handsome of men. Grace flows from your lips. God has blessed you forever." You know, mighty warriors, he says, this king is a mighty warrior. Strap your sword at your side in your majesty and splendor, and in your splendor, ride triumphantly in the cause of truth, humility, and justice. He's laying it on pretty thick of this wonderful king. And then, though, it seems in the middle of this psalm, it changes a bit. And I was going to say, you know, when I go in my Holman Christian Standard Bible, this psalm 17 verses, so I can't read the whole thing, but it has a heading on it. It says a royal wedding psalm. And it becomes apparent as you read the whole psalm that it's looking to a wedding. And he'll even speak to the female character in the psalm as well. But right in the middle, in this verse 6, he seems to move beyond this king. It wouldn't have been unusual to say to a king, you know, live forever. You see that in the book of Daniel when they speak to Nebuchadnezzar. But this says something more. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of justice or righteousness. You know, you love righteousness, hate wickedness. And look at this. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy or the oil of gladness more than your companions. And that's the part that the author of Hebrews picks up and says, this is when the royal wedding psalm moved from the earthly king to the Son. And he's very explicit. See that the first few words of verse 8 in Hebrews 1, he says, but to the Son. Okay. So he, the author under inspiration of the Holy Spirit views this psalm in verse 6, switching to, words to Jesus. And it's of Jesus. You see how it calls Jesus? It says, your throne, God. The writer of Hebrews is telling us he is speaking to Jesus. Your throne, Jesus. Your throne, God. So you see here, this first chapter of Hebrews not only just hits you with this matter of him being the Son, but that he is God. That you can't get through Hebrews 1 and think that the writer thinks anything other than that Jesus is completely deity. And, as I've said before, all the other passages, clearly a kingdom passage, right? Because it's not just that his throne's forever, his scepter, the scepter is emblematic of his authority and his rule, is a scepter of justice. That hasn't happened yet. He will rule in justice in the kingdom. But this is not a first Advent psalm. It's a second Advent psalm. And this is important to us. One last expression that I'll point out, and I'll pause for any questions or comments. He says that, this is why God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy of beyond your companions. That word companions is metakoi, and it is Jesus, the king, and his companions. And what the psalmist is saying and what the author of Hebrews is saying is that your companions, that's the Christians, that's those that are companions with Jesus. And it's why I've mentioned the book before, but I just love the title. Vance's commentary on Hebrews is Companions of Christ, as I recall. He's getting it from this verse here, Companions of Christ. But it comes up again. If I jump to chapter 2, verses 10 to 11, it speaks of Jesus in Hebrews 2:10 that in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was entirely appropriate that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, should make the pioneer or the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. This sons and daughters being brought to glory in Hebrews 2:10 are the metakoi. They're the companions of Christ. They are us as Christians, according to chapter 1, verse 9, and Psalm 45, verse 7, or 6 and 7, we are participating in this kingdom that is forever, over which Jesus rules with a scepter of righteousness. See, so now he's bringing us into the picture. In Hebrews 3:14, he makes this statement, the writer of Hebrews, for we, Christians, have become participants in Christ, metakoi. Participants is companions, but it's really more than that. It's mutual sharers. It's partners, okay? So according to 3:14, we have become metakoi in Christ if we hold firmly until the end the reality that we had at the start. We are his companions, his metakoi, his mutual sharers in this kingdom. So let me stop there. Any question? Comment?
This is pretty much in line with Dillo's Final Destiny, where he talks about metakoi. It's not just believers, that it's, I hate to use the word persevering, but persevering believers, correct?
Well, that's going to depend, right? That's where, is it persevering believers who enjoy the kingdom versus some other believers who are excluded? I personally have always taken the view that the companions is everybody. However, not everybody enjoys the same experience in the kingdom. That's been my view. But yeah, that's a view that's seems to be held by Dillo and a number of others. That the companions would reflect some level of what's the word? Well, perseverance, like you said, and perseverance and fruitfulness. It is clear, and it's the reason I can see how he would come to that view. It's clear that the warning passage, although not quite too explicit in Hebrews 2, but as it builds on them with the later warning passages, that's the point of them, that there will be a consequence in the kingdom to those who do not persevere in faithfulness to Christ's word. And then the debate with them becomes, what's the consequence? Where we have widespread agreement, I'm a little different than Dillo on this, but we both agree they're not going to hell, which has been the common teaching of Hebrews 2, that they've lost their salvation, or as the Lordshippers would say, they were never saved. And we
Ken Wilson is of that opinion also, is he not?
Yes, he is. Because I haven't talked to him about Hebrews, but I have talked to him about the concept. And I know Joe Wall is, and I'm pretty sure Dave Anderson is. So it seems that, yeah, as y'all know, I mean, I've taken classes and have a degree from Grace School of Theology. So most of my own faculty members would say I'm wrong. But that's all right. And this is not a super big issue for me, but yeah. I mean, it's the way I've always taken it, that there is something to lose, but what, if you think about rewards as something that you appropriate in real time, okay, they're already reserved in heaven for you, according to what Jesus says, and according to what Peter says in 1 Peter 1, but you appropriate it in real time as you live a fruitful life, an obedient life. And so I've always viewed it as what you are losing is that which may have been appropriated, that was there reserved for you, okay, because you're a co-heir, but you didn't appropriate it. And it becomes also a question of, well, what are those rewards? We won't get all that here in Hebrews, but I think they have to do with your proximity to the Savior and the kingdom. How close will you be to him? That there will be a real relationship to be enjoyed. It will have to do with the commendation and the honor afforded you at the Bema. We're told that in some degree during the kingdom, we may have some position of authority. And so I think there's something to that as well. But anyway, that chases a rabbit, but no, it's a good point to make. And something for us to all wrestle with about these companions. They're clearly the Christians, but will all of them be in this kingdom? Now, meaning the millennium kingdom, the 1,000 years. Again, verse 8, verse 9, kingdom oriented, second advent oriented. And this is, again, it's so critical because when people want to pull out the warning passage in chapter 2 and talk about what it means, and I always say first, what's the context for it? What's the argument that the writer is making that gets forwarded, that gets fortified with the warning passage? The warning passage steps out of the theology for a moment, and it makes a very practical application. So you have to know what the theology is he's talking about. As we're seeing here, it's about the kingdom. So verse 10 through 12, because I'd like to at least get the chapter finished. I think we will. In the beginning, Lord, you established the earth. Who established the earth? Don't miss it. The writer is saying that Jesus did this. Okay. So, you know, you read this in Colossians that everything was made by him. You read this, you know, including the angels. You read in John's prologue, the John's gospel, nothing was made that wasn't made by Jesus. And, here he is quoting Psalm 102 to speak of Jesus, not only as the creator of the first heavens and earth, but this is one of those very few instances I think the Old Testament that without much detail points forward to a new creation, what we would think of from a dispensational standpoint as the eternal state. So look what he says. In the beginning, you established the earth. That's Genesis. Jesus, you made the earth and the heavens. The heavens is the sky, the space, the universe. Okay. That's what our prologue said. And we talked about it. He used a very neat term there, the aeons. Jesus, God made the universe through Jesus. But then he says, you know, they're going to perish, but you'll remain, right? So this speaks of Jesus's eternality. Those things that he made will go away, but he remains. They will wear out like clothing. This sounds like something that Peter would say in 2 Peter. And then that under a fervent heat, it'll all burn away. He says, you, Jesus, will roll them up. What will he roll up? He'll take like the heavens, the stars, and just roll them up like he's rolling up a poster or a painting and move it out of the way. And they'll be changed as easy as changing your shirt. However, you, Jesus, you're the same. You are immutable. You're unchanging. He's putting these God attributes, or as Charles Ryrie called them, perfections on your years will never end. So what a beautiful thing he says. And I put the Psalm 102 there, and you can just see that he's quoting there. But if he made everything, then he made the angels. And if he made the angels, he's superior to them. And not only did he make them, he's going to make them all again. He's going to make a new creation in the future. But unlike things that are created, the universe, the earth, and the angels, he's not created. He was the creator. And even when the things that are created may wear out and go away, like the material universe, he'll still be there. Okay. The last two verses, not hard ones, but one more quote from the Psalms. Another rhetorical question in verse 13. To which of the angels has he ever said this? And the answer is none. But it's great. It's Psalm 110, verse 1. Sit at my right hand until. Don't miss that. That's what makes this a second Advent Psalm. Jesus is at the right hand of the Father now. We know that because it said it in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 in the prologue. After making purification for sins, he, Jesus, sat at the right hand of the majesty on high. How long will he sit there? Psalm 110 says Jesus will sit at my right hand. See, this is the declaration of the Lord, Yahweh, to my Lord. And this psalm is what has resulted in some interesting discussion. Jesus uses this and says, well, who's he talking to? If God says to my Lord, who is he, right? And he says, sit at my right hand. Why? Your priestly function is over until I make your enemies your footstool. So this points to the second advent. The first advent was the priestly function. This is from that point in time till the time that God makes the enemies his footstool. And then you can see that because in verse 2, what's it say in Psalm 110? Again, you know, he quotes one verse from the psalm, but he's bringing in the bigger picture here. The Lord will extend your, Jesus's, mighty scepter from Zion, rule over your surrounding enemies. So this looks to Jesus being in Israel, in Zion, ruling over the whole world. And so he didn't say this to an angel. He said this to a son. And that's the writer's point. One more, just throwing argument on argument of Jesus' superior to angels. And then he kind of culminates, I would say, the first half of his argument with verse 14. It's not the end of the argument because he'll pick up in chapter 2 in a part we won't get to cover today, but he'll pick up another argument, which is more on a focus on Jesus' dominion and how we will participate in that dominion. And it's the dominion that was the command in the opening creation account in Genesis, that mankind, humanity, would take dominion over the planet. And what mankind failed to do, the new humanity in Jesus Christ will do during the kingdom. He will take dominion over the planet. That's one of the many reasons why the kingdom that Jesus takes has to be a literal kingdom on earth. Because otherwise humanity will have never fulfilled the Genesis command. So the last question, are they not all ministering spirits? Are the angels not all ministering spirits? Who do they minister to? Sent out to serve those who are going to inherit salvation. So his argument here, if the angels serve us, Christians, and we're merely the companions from the earlier verse to the Son, then the angels are below in status and so forth to the Son. In fact, the angels serve his companions. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing. Any question, thought, comment about that? This is a theologically deep chapter in Hebrews, and the sad thing is when he gets to chapter 5, he says this was easy stuff.
I wonder if Satan realized that he was going to be lower than humanity, mm-hmm. and he just couldn't stand it. And he said, no, I want to be God. I don't want this.
I think you're right. And I think that's what it was described to me this way years ago. And it makes a lot of theological sense. God comes to the planet that he's formed and he makes this little area called Eden. It's his garden, not Adam's, but he puts Adam in charge of it. You take dominion over it, expand the garden till it covers whole earth. And Satan has to look at this and say, how can that puny creature that you made from dirt supplant my authority? How can he be higher than me? I think that's exactly it. And I think that's a big part of the motivation. He does have delusions of grandeur and being God, but a puny, a human, to have the authority that he thinks is rightfully his. I think it's exactly what's going on there. Let me read. We have about 5 minutes. I want to read chapter 2. I don't have it on the screen. I just want to read it. There's just the piece that it's our troubling warning passage. Because I feel like if we can put it right now in the immediate context of what we just read, it'll help. And don't miss the way Hebrews 1 ends. Okay, there's an unfortunate chapter break that should not be there. Okay, it's there because it helps us reference parts of the book. It's not the end of the argument. It's sort of like stopping in the middle. Okay, he needed to set all that up and then he'll make this warning passage thing. But notice how he ended. He says that the angels serve those who are going to inherit salvation. Okay? That's not justification. Justification is now. When you put your faith in Christ, you're saved on the spot in that sense. You have the adoption of sons that Paul refers to in the book of Romans and a couple of other places. That's a legal declaration that you have all the rights, title, and privileges there to being a son of God. The Father looks at you as this new Christian. You've done nothing to deserve this. You didn't deserve it. You've received it freely by faith. And he makes a legal declaration. You are my son. You are my daughter forever. And it's a fascinating thing that we live in a time when people want to challenge that. And they want to say, well, if you want to know if that's true, you don't listen to God's promise that you're my son. You're my daughter forever. That's the adoption. You need to go look at this person's life because, God may be wrong about that. So we have that silliness going on. But you just understand that this all happens at the moment you receive Christ by faith. You don't inherit that later. You're adopted into the family at that moment, and you can never be unadopted, no matter what. Okay? The writer of Hebrews isn't even talking about that, but he uses the word salvation. So there tends to be among a lot of folks a misunderstanding that, oh, well, he's talking about justification. If he were talking about that, he wouldn't say inherit. This is future. Inherit just, that's a Greek word used there that doesn't always have the sense of inherit like a will, but it certainly means the idea that you will come into possession of something at a later point in time. That's the concept. It's the salvation you're going to come into possession of at a later point in time. That's the subject. Everything about all these Old Testament quotes that I read to you was about the kingdom, every single one of them. And so in that context of the coming kingdom, where Jesus will rule and reign with a scepter of righteousness, and we would be his companions during that time, the salvation we look to inherit is our participation in the kingdom. With that in mind, he then says, for this reason, chapter 2, verse 1. For what reason? For the reason that he's going to be, the son is going to be heir of all things, and he's going to rule over all things, and you're going to be his companions. For this reason, he says, we must pay attention all the more to what we've heard so that we don't drift away. We have to pay attention to what we've heard from Jesus so that we don't drift away. It's such heavy theology. He has to pick up on that application he's ultimately making. You don't get a lot of detail about his audience until chapter 10 in terms of their specific circumstances. They've been persecuted and so forth. It's easy for people with certain theological commitments today to look at the Hebrews and say, well, they're probably just a bunch of Christians that were faking it. They heard an altar call at the Baptist church and they went up there with tears in their eyes, and they wanted their free ticket to heaven, but they weren't in it. The author of Hebrews says something quite the opposite. You've been persecuted for years. You had your stuff stolen. They've been taunting you, ridiculing you, and all that stuff. It's not that these are fake Christians, but there is a temptation at some point when you suffer long enough. Would it really be any harm if we showed up at synagogue once in a while? Would it really be any harm? He says, pay attention all the more to what we've heard, what we've heard from Jesus, so that we will not drift away. For if the message spoken through angels, that's the law, that's the law of Moses, and you can read Galatians 3:19 for that. If it was legally binding, and it was at the time, and every transgression and disobedience received a just punishment, when you read the law of Moses, there's consequences there for what you do. Sometimes they're paying money. Sometimes it's the death penalty. He says, if that's the case, okay, put the argument in your mind. If Jesus is far superior to angels because he is, in fact, the Son of God, he's divine, he's the creator, he was appointed heir of all things. The angels gave you the law of Moses, and it was good, and it had consequences. But Jesus told you something far better. The whole prologue, and we did last week, I called it Son Revelation. If you take seriously the law of Moses, and we should, how much more seriously would you take Son Revelation, which he says is far superior. In the old days, you had the prophets, but then you had the Son. He says, every transgression and disobedience received a just punishment under the law, so much more so if you stray from Son revelation. How will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? If you neglect the promises Jesus has made of you being his companion in the coming kingdom because you are persecuted, if you're going to back away from that, you need to know there's consequences. Now, that raises the question of what those consequences are, and that's what we'll have to spend more time with next time. But I wanted to set it up where you think about this in the context in which it's offered. This salvation, So Great Salvation, wonderful title of Charles Ryrie's book taken from this, is the salvation of Hebrews 1:14 that you inherit. It's your participation in the kingdom. It is not your justification. Whatever the consequences are, they are kingdom-oriented. And if you look at verse 5, he says, for he, Jesus, God has not subjected to angels the world to come that we're talking about. And that world to come is the kingdom. That's just a Jewish expression. So everything in chapter 1 said we're talking about the kingdom. Chapter 2, verse 5 says we're talking about the kingdom. Chapter 1, verse 14 says it's a future salvation, one you'll inherit later, not one you have at this moment. And so this great salvation that you would have consequences for neglecting is about the kingdom and your participation. And he even says in verse chapter 2, 3, this salvation, kingdom, had its beginning when it was spoken of by the Lord, by Jesus. This is Son, S-O-N revelation, which we were told in chapter 1 is the superior revelation. Yeah, there's consequences for disobeying the law. How much more seriously should you take disobedience or a lack of faithfulness to Son revelation? It was confirmed to us by those who heard him. So, Just to say this, your choices to think about, and we'll explore them a little more next time. One, the warning passage is an empty threat. That's one you'll hear a lot of times from Christians who hold to eternal security, and they think that this verse is completely inconsistent with eternal security. So it's a rather contrived view, but very popular, that it's just an empty threat. It's not that you can really lose your salvation. Yes, that's what he's talking about, but no, it's just an empty threat to scare you. Two, it says you can lose your salvation. This is a favorite passage about people losing their salvation. The problem is it's not even talking about justification. Three, you have consequences in the kingdom in terms of a loss of reward, whether that either means that you don't get full participation in the millennial portion of the kingdom, or it, more my view, that you're there, but there's still consequences and loss of rewards. But those seem to be the choices. I'm going to stop there, stop the recording, but next time we'll try to wrestle more with that. I just felt like if I didn't set it up, we're going to have this big disconnect from the context.